Support for WPR comes from Milwaukee Film, presenting the 16th Annual Milwaukee Film Festival, featuring local, national, and international films, April 11th through the 25th. Tickets are at mkefilm.org.
We're discussing the repercussions of plea deals in the justice system here on The Morning Show. I'm Kedar Chirkant. Glad you could be here. According to the ACLU, plea bargaining takes place tens of thousands of times every day in our country. It's how more than 95% of all state and federal convictions occur. And now research by professors at UW Law School looks at the extent to which prosecutors use their plea bargaining power to preserve convictions. Have you ever taken a plea deal? What were the circumstances? It's 800-642-1234. Keith Findley is a UW Law School professor. He co-authored the paper called Plea Bargaining in the Shadow of a Retrial, Bargain Away Innocence. Keith, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks so much. I'm very happy to be with you.
Well, give us some working knowledge first of the court system. How do plea bargains work? What is a plea bargain?
So a plea bargain is a negotiated settlement of a criminal case. So the way it works is that person is charged with a crime, and then prosecutors have vast discretion about what to charge, what kind of penalties to seek, what to sort of threaten the defendant with. And then the parties engage in negotiation to agree on what the outcome will be. And that can take two forms. One form is called charge bargaining, which is where you bargain away some charges. And the other is sentence bargaining, where you bargain for a particular sentence or a recommendation for a particular sentence. In Wisconsin, judges are not bound by sentence bargains, but they can impose whatever they want. But the a joint agreement for a particular sentence carries a great deal of weight. The general theory in the literature is that, and that's what the title of the paper comes from, is that parties tend to bargain in the shadow of a trial, meaning they will assess what the likely outcome of the case would be, what the penalty would be after a trial, and then discount that by the likelihood of conviction. So for example, if the parties look at a case where the expected outcome after trial might be 10 years in prison, but they think there's about an 80% chance of conviction, an appropriate rational settlement to both parties would be a plea bargain to about 8 years in prison. That's sort of the dominant theory right now of how this process works.
Almost, I hear it's like you're wagering a bet. Like for defendants, if they have strong defenses, and even if they're innocent, they have a lot of pressure to err on the side of caution and accept a plea.
Absolutely. And it is sort of a gamble, because anytime you go to trial, you just don't know what will happen, what a jury will do. It's always a risky proposition, no matter how strong your claim of innocence or from the prosecutor's perspective, how strong their proof of guilt. You never know what's going to happen. And so you make a calculated risk, a guess as to what the outcome would be. In our system, this tends to mean that when assessing those risks, prosecutors are given particularly immense power and authority to sort of impose onerous potential consequences that enhance the likelihood that a person will accept a plea, whether they're guilty or not. And that comes in the form that over the last decades, we have seen legislatures add penalty crime after crime after crime to the statutes and ratchet up penalties so immensely. When you put that together with the fact that prosecutors have virtually unreviewable discretion about what to charge and what penalties to seek, as long as it's within the statutes, what that means is prosecutors can pile on charges and ratchet up the potential exposure far beyond what they actually want or believe would be just. But imposing immense risks that to a rational criminal defendant are unacceptable and induce them to seek ways to minimize the potential harm, whether they're guilty or innocent.
We're talking with Keith Finley, who's a professor at the UW Law School, co-authored this new paper on plea bargaining. It's called Plea Bargaining in the Shadow of a Retrial. You can join in. Do prosecutors have too much leeway to use plea bargains? How should that be addressed? 800-642-1234. Keith, let's look at your research seeming to show that plea bargaining puts people who are likely innocent under pressure to take a plea deal. Can you elaborate on your findings?
Yeah, sure. The literature has long theorized that there is what scholars call an innocence problem in plea bargaining, and that is just the very nature of the enterprise that I've just described to you is one that would be likely to induce innocent people to plead guilty to avoid the risk of even harsher outcomes. And there's some psychological studies, laboratory studies, that confirm that in a laboratory setting, people can indeed be induced to accept plea bargains to things they did not do. So what we sought to do was to examine that phenomenon in the real world, in real cases. The problem in real cases, of course, is that unlike the laboratory, we usually don't have access to ground truth. It's hard to identify who's actually innocent and who's not. So the way we went about it was to look at cases where people represented by innocence projects, innocence advocacy organizations, were seeking post-conviction relief in a case where they'd already been convicted. Now, this is not a perfect proxy for innocence because some of these people will no doubt be guilty despite their claim of innocence. But for a lot of complicated reasons that we explain in the paper, this is a pretty good proxy for actual innocence, given all the screening that goes through these cases before they ever make it to the litigation process. And so we looked at what was happening in these cases when people represented by actual innocence organizations sought a new trial, and then when courts actually granted them relief, that is, vacated their convictions and ordered a new trial. And what we found was that in these cases, cases with a uniquely high likelihood of actual innocence, and most of these are very serious crimes, by the way, prosecutors offered plea bargains in an attempt to preserve the convictions in about a quarter of the cases. And even perhaps more telling than that, when they offered plea bargains, the plea bargains they offered were uniformly extraordinarily generous. That is, plea bargains that sought to extract virtually nothing more from the defendant except preservation of the conviction. So in about 9 out of 10 of these plea offers, the plea bargain was to time served. Now, remember, which means it's a get out of jail free card to the defendant. But remember, these are largely murders, rapes, cases like this, cases where a prosecutor would never contemplate time served from the get-go. And so this is, given that trial shadow theory that I was describing before, this would seem to suggest that prosecutors are recognizing that in these cases, the likelihood of conviction at a new trial is close to zero. And yet they're still offering these plea bargains in an attempt to preserve these convictions.
But these irresistible plea bargains, how does that work for defendants of color? What about, minority and how those plea bargains look?
Well, it's probably not going to be a big surprise to recognize that this process tends to work particularly to the disadvantage of people of color. What we know from a lot of research is that at virtually every step of the criminal justice system, racial minorities are treated more harshly and are at a greater disadvantage than their white counterparts. We know that even in areas where the two racial groups commit crimes at about the same rate, the arrest rate for Blacks is much higher than for whites. Once they're arrested, the conviction rate is higher. Once they're convicted, the rate of sentence to prison is higher. And when we look at the exoneration cases, that is the cases where we know a person was wrongly convicted, once again, we see that for most crimes, Blacks are disproportionately affected by wrongful convictions as well. So this is a problem that uniquely impacts racial minorities, but we also have research that suggests that Blacks are probably at a greater disadvantage in the plea bargaining process itself, in part because implicit biases may be in place that will motivate system actors to try to preserve those convictions even more strenuously, but also because Black people tend to have far less confidence in the criminal justice system than their white counterparts, which means that the risks of going to trial look even greater to them. And so they may be, I'm hypothesizing here, they may be more vulnerable to the coercive effect of really generous plea offers.
UW Law School professor Keith Findley co-founded the Wisconsin Innocence Project more than two decades ago. He and his colleagues have looked at the power of plea bargaining in a new study. Do prosecutors have too much leeway to use plea bargains? How should it be addressed? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Keith Findley here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the inner workings of plea deals in the justice system. New research out of the UW Law School. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Jury trials in America are rare. Attorneys resolve the lion's share of cases through plea bargaining, as we've been talking about. That means the defendant waives their right to a trial, agrees to plead guilty to certain charges. The ACLU concluded last year that coercive plea bargaining has poisoned the criminal justice system, and criminal case dockets have become so overloaded over the past half century that, quote, conveyor belt plea bargaining has become the only release valve, end quote. UW Law School professor Keith Findley and his colleagues looked into the power of plea bargains, and he stays with us for about nine more minutes. Keith, we had a caller who couldn't stay with us. They want to know if coercion plays a role in plea bargains.
Well, sure. I mean, it all depends on how you define coercion, though. Under the law, a plea bargain that's coerced is invalid. But because a plea bargain involves waiver of a whole host of constitutional rights. The right to a jury trial, the right to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, the right to remain silent. The list goes on. And so the courts, in theory, want to make sure that those pleas are entered what they, and the legal term for that is knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently, which means without coercion. The problem comes in, though, in identifying what is coercion. And what has been theorized and what I think our research supports is that pleas that look on their face to meet that legal standard of voluntariness, in fact, may in reality be coercive in the sense that to the criminal defendant, the risks of proceeding to trial are so overwhelming compared to the overly generous offer that's being made that it's kind of like, the Godfather, they made an offer you can't refuse. So in that sense, they appear to be coercive.
I understand that plea bargains have surged over time, and at the same time, jury trials have become more time-consuming, more complex, lawyers drawing them out. Are there forces at work here with jury trials being this long-involved legal mechanism?
That may be part of what's going on, but my suspicion that I think is supported by the literature is that probably the primary factor that's driving the disappearance of jury trials and the emergence of the plea process as the dominant process for resolving criminal cases is the over criminalization of our statutes. That is the explosion of options that are available to prosecutors. And the ratcheting up of statutory maximum penalties. Since the 70s, essentially, we have seen a political movement that has been fairly sustained until recently involving get tough on crime, which means every time something goes wrong, the legislatures create a new crime and the penalties keep going up higher and higher. The reason that causes trials to disappear is that because it gives prosecutors such an arsenal to work with. It every time we add to the statutes or add to the penalties, you strengthen the hand of the prosecutors, so they are able to charge far more than what they really want, and it allows them to ratchet up the potential penalties so high that most rational defendants simply can't take the risk of going to trial. It's a world in which, as some commentators have noticed, it's ironic that the more laws we have, the less relevant the law becomes, because it gives prosecutors so many options that the law doesn't dictate the outcome so much as does the preferences of the prosecutor.
Let's bring on a caller now. Lauren is joining us from Burlington. Hi, Lauren. What would you like to add?
Hi. I guess I'm looking at things from two perspectives. I used to be an insurance claims adjuster who handled civil cases. I am also now a mental health therapist, so I'm seeing some of the criminal aspects of it. I have a couple of clients who are involved in the system as we speak. I have two views on this, both related to that I believe the justice system is broken. I do not believe that there is justice anymore anywhere in the country. First reason, people that are innocent are having to plead guilty to things that they do not do because they are looking at long jail sentences, a chance that the jury will find them guilty anyway because of color, socioeconomic status. Second, I am aware of a case of a Facebook friend who was brutally, brutally murdered 2 years ago. There has not been a preliminary hearing, not one preliminary hearing. The victims are videotaped the killing of this gentleman. He was totally tied into a bed.
And
totally
Lauren, I want to pause here for a moment, and because I think you bring up a really good point on the role of victims in plea bargaining. What happens to the victims, Keith?
Well, victims have certain rights in our legal system, and including to be apprised of the proceedings and the nature of the bargains, and the generally speaking, the prosecutor is required to notify them of what's going on and hear their concerns. But they aren't parties in the litigation, so they are not direct negotiators in the plea bargaining process.
Keith Findley, professor at the UW Law School, co-author of a paper on plea bargaining. You can join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. So, Keith, you know, here we're driving at this, but if we almost never test prosecution's evidence through a trial, or like 95% of the time we don't, then how can you get at the truth of what happened in a case? What I'm really asking, what is the solution here?
Well, you know, there are a number of potential solutions, large and small. I mean, given what I've said already, probably the most effective thing, but the one that is almost politically unthinkable and would require massive shifts, is to reduce the size, the imprint of the criminal justice system. That is, start repealing overlapping criminal statutes, start scaling back potential punishments so that prosecutors don't have that overwhelming advantage in the negotiating process quite so much. There are a lot of other ways you can sort of level the playing field as well. But then when it comes to the plea bargaining process itself, there are a number of proposals out there that are kind of interesting that generally involve injecting the judicial oversight into the process a little bit more. In our system, judges pretty much take a hands-off approach to the bargaining process, and for good reasons, because you don't want the judge to appear biased or to put pressure on someone to accept a plea bargain. But there are ways to inject some judicial oversight that can avoid those risks. One of the more interesting ones that I've seen that we talk about in the paper a little bit is a system where you could impose a process where you have what are known as trial penalty caps, and what that means is that if a prosecutor wants to offer a plea bargain, he can do so. It has to be on the record, and then if the plea bargain is rejected, everybody knows the case goes to trial. the penalty that can be imposed after a trial would be capped at a certain marginal increment above what the plea bargain was.
Oh.
That way we know that everyone knows going in that the risk of going to trial isn't just astronomical, and everybody knows what it will be up front. The incentive for the prosecutor has for offering overly generous and therefore coercive plea bargains is reduced because they know it will tie their own hands later if they go to trial. So there are things like that that can happen. In the end, what we really need is, well, because regardless of what we do, prosecutors are going to remain probably the most powerful actors in our criminal justice system and certainly in the plea bargaining process. What we really need also is prosecutors to take the lead themselves, to impose some constraints on their own ability to charge more than they really want, and to negotiate in ways that are not coercive.
Keith, thank you for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for letting me talk about the research.
Keith Findley is a professor at the UW Law School, co-founder of the Wisconsin Innocence Project, co-author of a new paper on plea bargaining that will be published in the Wisconsin Law Review. We have a link, by the way, at wpr.org/mornings. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network.